Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Nation of Writers. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Chicago legend Nelson Algren, one of the most well-known literary writers in America in the 40s and 50s, who eventually fell into obscurity toward the end of his life. Algren is perhaps best known for his novels such as A Walk on the Wild Side and The Man with the Golden Arm, which won the first National Book Award for Fiction in 1949. Algren also wrote short stories, articles, reviews, and poems, including his iconic prose poem, Chicago, City on the Make. Algren's writings focused on the poor, inspired by routine naturalism and its vision of pride, humor, and unquenchable yearnings. He captured the poetic essence of the city's underside, its jukebox pounding, distinguishable stench, and neon glare. For this episode, we are joined by Algren scholars Sue Rutson and Richard F. Bales. You can find their bios in our show notes. Sue and Richard are interviewed by Nate King, Digital Content Associate at the American Writers Museum.
Well, thank you, Sue and Dick, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. I'm excited to talk to you both about Nelson Algren, who I know you're both big fans of and have been for a long time. So let's first start, if you could both tell me a little bit about yourselves, what you've been up to, if you got anything coming out in the pipeline. Sue, maybe you could start.
Well, I'm semi-retired from the financial services industry. I basically run the Nelson Algren Museum and a small community fund here in Miller Beach, Indiana. I guess the only thing I'm really working on, we just finished up the year for events with Algren, but we're trying to figure out what we'll do next year. And I think it's going to include something on the boxer's name on Hurricane Carter, because that was Algren's last, very last novel. And there's so many other people that come into this this cause that I think it'd be interesting to people to revisit everything. So
sounds great. And Dick, how about yourself? I know you got the book just came out, The Short Writings of Nelson Algren.
And Nate, I spent about 10 years working on that book. And now that it's out, I'm already back to working on a book. I quit working halfway through. I just got burnt out on it, but it's going to be a fascinating book. It's a saga of George Wellington Cap Streeter and the creation of Streeterville. And but besides that, I, like Sue, am also semi-retired, and I've spent my entire life working in the area of real estate, title insurance. I'm a real estate lawyer, and I still work 2 days a week for proper title insurance in the Naperville office.
And still find time to write. Well, I guess it took you 10 years on this one, but yeah, that makes sense, though, because there's this, as I've been reading the book, it's very detailed and a lot of, I can tell the amount of research that went into it. And it's quite an impressive book. And I'm curious if you could talk a little bit more about the book and what that process was like for you to research and find all these. In your introduction, you were like the lost literature of Nelson Algren, right?
All right, sure. But I'd love to. Yeah, the working title of my book was always The Lost Literature of Nelson Algren. That was going to be a nice, short, and pithy and alliterative. But my publisher, my publisher said, well, our research has found that books with titles have the words lost and forgotten in them don't sell as well as they might otherwise. And so they had to change the book title on me. But I got interested in him like many years ago, and I think concerned is too strong a word, but it bothered me that he was always well known for his novels when he had written so much more. There's a quote, I love the quote, I use it at least a couple times in my book, but it appeared originally in Mary Wazinski's biography of Algren by Rick Kogan, who's his Tribune writer, whose father, Herman Kogan, was a friend of Algren's. And Rick says that he thought that Algren's true genius lied in his short stories, his works other than his novels. And I knew, the funny story is that I started collecting everything that Algren had written, and he had written so many of these articles for men's magazines with forgettable titles like Swank and what's the other titles? Gent was another one. And so there was Every year there's it's called the Windy City Pulp and Paper Show, which is in the Lombard, at the Hotel Lombard. And I would go there and go on my hands and knees. I'd be going through these cardboard boxes, looking for men's magazines, looking for all good articles that appear in these men's magazines. I like to tell people that I have the finest collection of softcore porn of the 1950s and 60s featuring Olga than anybody else in the world. And as I amassed these things, I started to go through them, and I wanted to write a book which emphasized and publicized these writings that people didn't know about. And that was basically the gist of my book.
I love the imagery of you on hands and knees. Yes. I think in your intro, you're like, much to your wife's chagrin as well.
Yes. I mean, toward the end, she wouldn't even go there anymore. She hated the place.
A labor of love, you know, I produced this book. And why do you think up until now that's kind of been a neglected part of his literary output? You know, he's a novelist, right? He's referred to as a Chicago novelist, but he's so much more. And I'm curious why you think that is.
That's funny, Nate. And Sue, you said the same thing, that my gosh, here she is almost like I put the missing piece in the puzzle of his life, because no one until now has ever discussed it. And I don't really know why. I think maybe it's because it was so much easier to cover the novels and the things, you know, as opposed, although what was his name? Brooke Howard, was it? Did write a book on his that touched upon his other writings, but really no one until now has dived so far deep into the things other than his novels. I suppose because, and this is certainly not to pat myself on the back, but I think because it really was a difficult task to do this. I mean, look at the book reviews, for goodness sakes. The book reviews, I spent so many years just at the History Museum, Chicago History Museum, and the Chicago Public Library, photocopying these book reviews in these newspapers and things, and just copying them, and just spent days upon days upon days just copying this stuff, you know, just to get them. When I wanted some things out of the Critic magazine, which was a magazine published by Notre Dame. So I had to pay my a friend of mine's daughter, who was a student there, to go to the library and photocopy these things for me. I did everything I could just to get these copies of things. I now have, I've got 13 three-ring binders of just photocopies of all this stuff I use. So I think that's why the reason it took so long was because it was so difficult to do.
Yeah, I imagine with, you know, writing in that time where he was with all those kind of short-lived, I'd imagine, two men's magazines that you're talking about, kind of hard to track all those down. And yes. You mentioned some libraries and stuff. Were there any other sort of archives that were helpful to you? Did you work with the Nelson Algren estate on it as well?
Oh yes, I did. I worked very much so. I could not have done this without working with the Nelson Algren estate. Luckily, I think it was maybe his niece. I think that was the relationship. But her name was Bernice, and I would not be able to do this, frankly, without her cooperation. And she was very cooperative. So I was very lucky in that respect to work with her so well.
Sue, I want to switch to you a little bit. Speaking of archives, can you tell me about a little bit about your museum in Miller Beach in Indiana?
Well, we really came together. I was living in Chicago, and I knew I was living close to where Nelson Algren used to hang out, and I majored in English, so I was aware of him. Mm-hmm. And then I bought a second home here in Miller Beach, and somebody asked, oh, is Nelson Algren's cabin still there? And I had no idea what they were talking about, but sure enough, the cabin is still here. And I decided we needed to make sure everybody knew about this connection to Nelson Algren and Miller Beach. So my husband and I took classes at the Chicago History Museum. We took a tour, and we just kind of went down the rabbit hole. We just fell in love with Nelson Algren. And so whatever we would do or talk about, it would always refer somehow back to Nelson Algren. So we started as a society, and then shortly thereafter, I asked Art Shea, who is a very good friend of Nelson Algren, to come and exhibit here. And of course, he was like 94 years old. Luckily, he's 10 years younger than Nelson. But he came to Miller and exhibited his photography. And I bought 4 of his photographs. And then he gave me the other 18 free of charge. So now we have a collection of 22 photographs by a man who has hung photographs all over the world. So
yeah, that's great. At that point,
we had to become a museum. And they also helped us get Algren's desk, typewriter, and chair.
Oh,
and
neat.
So it would be pretty hard to like lug that desk around to different exhibits. So luckily, Indiana Landmarks gave us space in an old building that used to be owned by Nelson's friend, Dave Peltz. So, I mean, it just kind of comes together. It's almost magical how everything hangs together. So we brought in, I think Dick was one of our earliest speakers, and we've just brought in every biographer, Bettina Drew, Mary Wisniewski, and Colin Asher. We brought in Bill Savage from Northwestern University, who's kind of like the premier expert on Algren. And then we brought in a couple Rolling Stone writers. Anthony DeCurtis had just written a book on Lou Reed. And so he came to visit. He gave a speech about Lou Reed, and then he sang Lou Reed songs. And so that was kind of our wildest night. We really had a good time that night.
Wild being the operative word there, right?
Pardon? Well, yeah, exactly.
Wild being the operative word there, right? Take a walk on the wild thing.
And then another Rolling Stone writer by the name of Holly George Warren, who had written on Janis Joplin, she came, and we had a backup band after that. And so we've just been having some wonderful, wonderful events. And Dick was the last speaker we've had now. So we're kind of done for the year and figuring out what we'll do next. Can I just say about Lou Reed? Why are we interested in Lou Reed and Janis Joplin? And it's because the influence of Nelson Algren. Lou Reed had written the music to Take a Walk on the Wild Side in his high school years, but he never had any lyrics. But his mentor and teacher, Delmore Schwartz, said, you got to check out Nelson Algren, because Algren writes about people in the street, common language. And so Lou Reed looked at some of Walk on the Wild Side, which was Nelson's 4th novel. And that's where he came up with the idea for Candy and Little Joe and, you know, the rest of the characters from the street that are totally unforgettable. And so nobody's known about that connection. I think I'm the first person to bring that to light. And then Janis Joplin, in her biography by Holly, it said on page 14 that she went to see Man with the Golden Arm when she was 14 years old. And I go, okay, there's the connection. But of course, you know, she did die of a heroin overdose. And that is the subject of, morphine addiction in Man with the Golden Arm. But, you know, it's just kind of like Algren touches many, many artists that today we still admire.
Yeah, that's a great point. I didn't know about the Lou Reed connection, and the story behind that song too is such an interesting one. If there are so many things I want to jump off of that last segment, but I want to go back to Art Shea. So I'm glad you both in the those questions we went over earlier, you both mentioned that book as kind of being your introductions into Algren. And and we at the museum, we had an exhibit of Art Shea's work on display as well. There's one, I mean, a section of the exhibit was about his friendship with Algren. And there's one picture that's a great one of the two of them behind a pool table. That's been like stuck in my mind. But yeah, so I want to backtrack to that. Like, what was your first introduction to Algren? It was from that book. And then, like you said, Dick, you were like, wow, I got to read him more. So yeah, I'm just curious if you remember the first time you read anything by Nelson Algren.
Yeah, it was about at least 10, 12 years ago, maybe. And it was, I first picked up Art Shea's book, started reading that, kind of reading just about Algren. I thought that was very interesting. And so then I got my first book was The Man with the Golden Arm. And I still have that book, you know, is the first one I got. And I just read that. I was just amazed at how well he wrote. And then from there, things just took off. And I think after that, I think like Sue, I read early on his biography by Bettina Drew, the first one. And there have been, of course, two more since then, but that was the first one I read. And I ended up reading, I think, books about Ogden before I got back into reading more of the things that he wrote, his other novels, for example.
How about you, Sue? Do you remember your first reading experience of Nelson Algren?
Well, it's similar to Dick's, that the Art Shea book is so intriguing because you see the two of them hanging out in Chicago doing stuff that your parents don't want you to hang out with these guys, you know. That's but yeah. And then the life story is what brought me in, because Nelson Algren's story, it just is like, it's endless, the twists and turns, and how he's really a reflection of everything happening in the United States. From he was born in 1909, he died in 1981, and he was part of, you know, the European immigration here, and then the Red Scare and the Writers Project, the Great Depression. I mean, you name it, he's there. And so just on a historical basis, I was fascinated with him. And then I started reading his literature.
Yeah, that's a great point about his placement in American history, let alone American writing. But yeah, I mean, he, you know, survived, and he survived a pandemic as well, right? Like if he's born in 1909, that means he's around 10 when the influenza pandemic hits. And then there's also two world wars he went through, and then the Red Scare, McCarthyism, and all that. How do you think his writing was impacted by the events he witnessed in his life? Because he's very, I've always liked him as a champion of the working class people, regular everyday people who, I don't know, sometimes get the short end of the stick, right? Through no fault of their own. And so I'm curious if how the events of the world and the country had impacted his writing.
Well, I think that was almost his raison d'etre, really. I mean, early on, I remember reading back in the 30s, he went to Southern Illinois to cover some labor unrest. I think he was going to write for The Nation magazine, I think it was. And so he was concerned about protesters getting a fair shake. And so he drove down there basically to observe them, the protests, to make sure that they weren't harmed or anything. So he was doing that even back then. And of course, after realizing he spent his entire life, I think, fighting for injustice. The classic example is the Rosenbergs, you know, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were tried as spies, and they were sentenced for execution. And Algren, along with hundreds of other thousands of other people, were just so upset about this that they would be executed for this. And he joined a Chicago committee to protest this. And there's that there's an interesting quote. He was talking to one of his books. He was being interviewed, and he told the interviewer that, "I'm not saying that they were innocent. I'm just saying that we shouldn't have burned them," is what he said, because they really were executed. And of course, the federal government would try to do everything they could to get them to not execute them. The story was that all they wanted to do was them to name names, for Julius to name names. And they refused to do so. They went to their death because they refused to name names, just like the 50s, you know. So, and of course, the Hollywood 10, that was during, of course, the height of the Cold War, when people in Hollywood were being asked to again name names and to say that they weren't communists. And some people said, like Gary Cooper and Ronald Reagan said, "Sure, we'll testify." Well, 10 directors and movie actors refused to testify, saying, "Look, it is my constitutional right to remain silent." And in return, they went to prison, and then they were blacklisted afterwards. But Bettina Drew interviewed, I think it was Albert Maltz, I think, when she was writing her book in 1984. And he was part of the Hollywood 10. And he said, when everybody else was running away, Algren was out there in front, championing us. That is so cool.
Yeah. And another thing is that, you know, that Algren, Bettina Drew said this at one of our conferences. She said, Algren teaches me about compassion. Hmm. And that is, I think, the main word in Algren is compassion. And if you go back to his early life, you know, he graduated from the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, in 1931 with a journalism degree. And he could not find a job for love or money. So he rode the rails and he lived like a hobo. And he was hungry. He was beaten. He saw horrible things on the rail. And then he ended up, Saul Ross University allowed him to use their typewriter in Alpine, Texas. And so when he left that area, he realized he had no typewriter at home. And so he decided he would just pick up this Royal Upright, address it to his parents, and send it off on the Union Pacific Railroad. Well, he was arrested within a couple hours and thrown in jail, where he stayed for at least, well, some people say 3 weeks, some 4 weeks, waiting trial. And in that time, he is sleeping on cement floors. He's seeing a man, a prisoner who died because he didn't get the most rudimentary medical care. And the jailers were psychopaths, and his fellow jail people in jail with him were psychopaths also. But he's only like 24 years old. So this was a horrible, horrible experience for him that he never forgot. And he always put a jail scene in his 5 novels. So, you know, he has compassion for the guy on the street who doesn't have socks and he can't find anything to drink and he's cold, he's hungry, there's nowhere to sleep. He cares about, he wants us to care about people like that.
Compassion's a great word. You're right. And it's so impressive to me how he was able to do that within his writing. You know, it's not necessarily like saying outright, you need to care about these people, but he tells you their stories with honesty and compassion. He cares about them as a writer. So as a reader, you have no choice if you're going to get into his books. That does bring me to another point, and we kind of have mentioned it, but in my research of him and reading your book, Dick, his use of just everyday language, it seems to be a defining characteristic of his work, like just writing how people talk. I don't know if it was in your book, Richard, or in the document of questions that I sent you, but I think you mentioned maybe something along the lines of he went to some writers conferences. I thought that was a fascinating detail, and some of them referenced a Walt Whitman quote, about, you know, kind of writing for the common people. If you have any more thoughts to add to that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if you were to ask anyone who knows anything about Algren, who influenced Algren, of course, they're going to say, Richard Wright, you know, a native son. In fact, Algren gave Richard Wright the title Native Son for the book, and they're going to reference that. And maybe they'll reference Theodore Dreiser as well. But I think in my research, I think that he was truly influenced. I mean, we're calling it a lasting influence by two people, Benjamin Botkin and also Hyde Partnow, because Algren went to the third writers conference in New York City, and Botkin gave a talk. If I may tell you, read what he wrote. He said what he said. He said, "What makes literature about the folk particularly variable and valid as literature is the attempt to make the inarticulate articulate, and above all, to let the people speak in their own voice and tell their own story by recording and stimulating the worker as writer." But then also Hyde Partnow, who I think, as I recall, was with the New York City Writers Project, also spoke. And he especially, I think, influenced Algren, because he said, "I only know the best of today's writing must be in the present It is this earth today. It is a life of one man or one woman today. The average man of today, any man, I only know that to write well today, you've got to go out to the people and hear what they're saying. And in so doing, believe, as Walt Whitman did, that, quote, not till the sun excludes you do I exclude you. And as we all know, Ogden would often, in fact, he put it in his next book, Never Come Morning. And he often said, he would say this all the time, in a 1958 Tribune article, he wrote this: I took my cue a long time ago in a novel called Never Come Morning from Whitman. These are the lines: I feel I am one of them. I belong to those convicts and prostitutes myself, and henceforth I will not deny them, for how can I deny myself? And I think I can't help but think he got that from Hyde Park now, back when he went to the writers' conference many, many years ago. And again, people talk about, you know, Richard Wright influencing them, but I can't help but think that Benjamin Botkin and Hyde Park now also influenced, made a lasting influence on him. Because then, just a few months later, Ogden gave a talk at the Illinois Writers Project in Chicago. And I was actually got a copy of the transcript from the Library of Congress. And you could tell that Ogden then was talking. Jack Conroy was there. Margaret Walker was there. While Olga was giving this talk at the Illinois Writers Project, and he was talking how he'd gone there, was influenced by them, and he said, we want to do the same thing they're doing in New York. You could tell he was influenced by what he heard in New York City.
I love that little story. That's great. And the obvious connection that you draw the line from that conference to what Ogden himself says later about Whitman. There's another moment, I think it's, again, I'm not sure if it was in the book or in those answers that you sent in the document, but mention of a line Ogden has about his poetry, and I'm going to paraphrase, but it's something along the lines of, it's like the best lines of his poems or anything really that people have said back to him were things he heard or repeated by people who maybe couldn't even read, let alone write. And I just thought that was a beautiful, another moment of compassion, just listening to people and hearing the poetry in everyday language. And it reminds me of, of Studs Terkel too, and that, who I know they were friends as well, but just going out and talking and listening. Seems kind of feels like a lost art form nowadays. I don't know.
Yeah. Yes, that was a sentence. Two people, Martha Hughesley Cox and Wayne Chatterton, wrote an early, I guess you'd call it a biobibliography of Ogden. And that quote you just read was buried in that book. I was just so fascinated by it. And this is the exact quote, if I may read it again. My most successful poetry, the lines people throw back at me years after they were written, were lines I never wrote. They were lines I heard and repeated, usually by someone who never read and couldn't write. Think about that.
Yeah, right, exactly. And that, I mean, that just, you rereading that just made me think, like, down the line, Lou Reed does the same thing, more or less. he takes some Ogden lines and ideas and makes a whole classic song out of them. We've mentioned a little bit of his influences. Are there any other writers who you can tell had a, or know even through his own writing, that had a direct impact on him?
I did some research on this thing, and there was one. Stuart Dybeck wrote this. You know, he's a famous Chicago author, obviously. If I don't think I ever quite looked at the city in the same way after reading The Man with the Golden Arm. All the attitudes one acquires without reflecting acquires from street life itself that permit a certain numbness toward the daily downtrodden were called into question. Each had a story, meaning each had a soul.
Yeah, I like that quote as well, because that goes back to that compassion, that, you know, overarching quality of Ogden is, if you have a story to tell, you're worth it to listen to. What about, I'll switch gears a little bit and get into maybe kind of like his personal life a little bit, because that is, you mentioned it earlier, Sue, I think that in and of itself is a great story, a great American novel, if you will, like, from everything from, we mentioned the during the Cold War and his the McCarthyism and his sort of battles against censorship, and then there's an FBI file on him, and then the international love affair with Simone de Beauvoir. So yeah, Sue, maybe you could speak to this a little bit. What any sort of hot gossip you got on Algren that you can share with us?
Well, he's a source of hot gossip to this day. There's always stories that are popping up. So he was in Texas trying to write, you know, this was before Grapes of Wrath was published. So Vanguard Publishing was trying to get a writer on the field about what's happening in the country in the 30s, and he got a contract. So he published his first book, and that didn't do very well, and he published a second, and that didn't do well. Now he's back in Chicago, and he tried to commit suicide at one point because he was failing. And so, and now he was working with the Writers Project in Chicago and getting to know Richard Wright and so many other people, Suds Terkel, Margaret Walker. And I think that Gwendolyn Brooks was also there because she read the eulogy for his at his funeral. But anyway, so he's hanging out with these very fascinating people. And then something just went all right. You know, he published Man with the Golden Arm in 1949, and all of a sudden he was on top, and he was quoted and interviewed, and he was just hot. He was really exciting to talk to, and was on television, radio, and all over.
He won the very first National Book Award, right? For fiction? Yeah.
So here he is, and then he meets Simone de Beauvoir, and they have a torrid love affair, and Otto Preminger comes in, and he's going to do a movie with Frank Sinatra and Kim Novak. And it's at this point that he took a little money that he got from the screenplay of Man with the Golden Arm, and he bought this small cabin here in Miller. So he was really flying high. He was so in love with Simone, and she was so in love with him. But that was the peak, I would say, by 19, he couldn't get Walk in the Wild Side, that didn't go very well. And so he started just going downhill as an author, because he basically stuck with the same products, the same sources that he had always stuck with. And the world changed, and he did not. You know, after the war, we're into post-war prosperity and boom, 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 and who wants to read about poor people? No one wanted to read about poor people in the street. So he really fell out of favor, and that's when he did so much writing that Dick has covered in his book, just to pay the rent. And it really just is a very sad story all the way to the end of his life.
Yeah, that later part of his life is, like you said, that, he reaches his that peak, like you said, but then the fall is a pretty harsh fall. It seems as so in my research and reading your book, Dick.
What really bothers me, he spent so much of, Sue mentioned earlier about the Devil's Stocking, and he had spent so many years, he sold his home, and sold everything in Chicago, not his home, sold everything in Chicago, moved to New Jersey to work on freeing Reuben Carter, and then worked on the book about called The Devil's Stocking, and spent years working on that. And I don't know about you, Sue, but I think the book is just awful. It's an awful, awful book. And you could tell he talks about when he wrote The Man with the Golden Arm, he would rewrite it and rewrite it constantly. And there isn't much rewriting in The Devil's Stocking. And all I could think of is that, and people have mentioned this too, that instead of working on that, if he could have spent his time maybe writing, if he didn't want to write a novel, writing quality articles that are short stories, I should say, short stories. He won book awards for his short stories early on. He could have spent his time doing that. Look like Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett, those kind of people. He could have been another one of them. He could have been writing quality work instead of wasting his time on the devil's stocking. Or as Joe Pistaro wrote a marvelous article for Chicago Magazine about his last year in Sag Harbor. And he said that Joe writes the same thing. He said he wasted his time writing devil's stocking. He could have been, if he wanted to, he had friends in Paris. He could have gone back to Paris where he went with Simone and made Simone jealous, you know, doing that. He enjoyed himself, but he didn't, you know.
Yeah.
In terms of influence, you're reminding me that when Alvin died, he was preparing to have a party the next day for being admitted into the Academy of Arts and Sciences. And who was going to come to his party was Kurt Vonnegut and Salman Rushdie, because Salman Rushdie said, I want to meet Nelson Algren. So they were prepared to come to the party, but unfortunately, Algren died that night. And has talked about this. It's not like Algren made very good decisions in terms of his health. So that's pretty sad. But I mean, that's the influence that Algren has had.
Yeah. Now that would have been a great party to be a fly on the wall. And that reminds me too. Dick, in your book, you at least two Ernest Hemingway quotes that you lead at the introduction with one, and then I believe it's the epilogue also has a quote that Hemingway is praising Algren. I believe there it quotes from letters to friends or other writers, but. It's just interesting to me that he, Algren, had such a respect among his peers and adoration even, but for some reason nowadays, I don't know, like me personally, I didn't know much about Algren until I moved here in Chicago and started working at the museum. I'm just curious as to why. I wonder if it's maybe his later in life sort of fall off that has lent itself to him being less prominent in like English classes or American literature classes. I don't know. It's fascinating.
It's funny you mentioned that. If I may spend some time about that. I kind of mentioned that in the book, especially when I talk about the anthologies, because I've got an appendix of all the, I think there were 96 anthologies that I actually found that reference Algren's work. Now, granted, most of them, there aren't as many now as there were back in the 50s and 60s, but there is at least one current one, Joyce Carol Oates anthology, second edition, does feature Algren. I know, so he is still in anthologies. James Giles, former NIU, Northern Illinois University English professor, wrote two books on Algren. And he says in both of them that Algren has yet to be entered into the canon of American letters. And so I'm asking myself, well, why is that? And in fact, I forgot to tell you, I've actually finished writing a second book on Algren. I did so much research the first time around, wrote a second book. I have a whole section on why he's not in the canon. And I'm convinced that I think if I were 10 years younger, Nate, if I was 10 years younger, I would try to work with the Algren estate and publish a book of his published poetry. His published poetry with commentary, maybe annotated a book of his poetry. But I cannot help but think that if people could see how great his poetry was, he might get into the canon. I think the reason he's not in the canon now is because, like Sue mentioned, his last work really wasn't in the last part of his life, wasn't as great as the first part. People only see the devil's stocking, for goodness sakes. They don't see what else was out there, the good stuff. And I think that's what we need, a book of his poetry. And I'm 71 now, but if I were only 61, I'd be doing it. So that would be wonderful. I mean, he was just a marvelous, marvelous poet. And that's really what I tried to do in my book, was make people realize there's so much else out there that he wrote beyond the novels. And that's what I wanted to do, is somehow bring him back more into prominence by writing my book.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, as I'm reading it, you do a great job of that. That's for sure. In our museum, the American Writers Museum, in our Chicago gallery, we have a nice kind of video animated montage of some of the quotes and lines from Chicago City on the Make, that poem, long form poem, but it I don't know. Those are some of my favorite lines I've read in literature is from that book, that poem. And you have a whole section in your book dedicated to that, to City on the Make as well. So I wanted to, I know you sent me some, I think you both did sent me some favorite quotes of Algren. So I'd love to hear more of his work through your voices, if you have any favorite lines or stanzas or quotes that you'd like to share with us.
I have my two favorite funny ones, and I'll go deeper into it than I will. But Algren, it's been called the three rules of adulthood. Number one, never play cards with a man named Doc. Number two, never eat at a place called Mom's. And three, never sleep with a woman whose troubles are worse than your own. Now those are good rules.
Those are. I was just going to say the same thing. Yeah.
Another quote was, money can't buy everything. Poverty, for example. So, you know, he was just a really witty, funny guy that, you know, he'd be the guy you'd want to hang out with at parties. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And those are great examples of that. That's what I, and he's also funny in a biting way, like the poverty quote, for example. Like that's, he's making a joke, but also making some good social commentary in just a few words. Dick, do you have any favorite lines or passages you want to share?
Well, I guess mine aren't really funny quotes, but again, one of the things, excuse me, I discovered was in the January 1950 issue of Negro Digest. He wrote an article basically on black and white race relations. And this is back in 1950. Like I say in my book, this is probably before the parents of the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement were born. I mean, back then,
right.
He was just so prescient. And I just love this quote he wrote. He said this, "And out of the curtain corners of the Negro slums of Paul, the pall of human beings living in misery creeps out of the city's farthest suburb and over the land like an unseen fog. For no slum is an island. Chicago is tied together like the body of a man, and we cannot ignore a great sore in one part and yet not expect other parts to be affected."
Wow. Yeah.
Another famous one is, "Yet once you've come to be a part of this particular patch, you'll never love another. Like loving a woman with a broken nose, you may well find lovelier lovelies, but never a lovely so real."
Yeah, that's one of my favorites too. That's from City on the Make, right? The Chicago poem.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, like that, again, reminds me of that compassion you spoke of, Sue. You know, that's finding, I think another one I like from City on the Make is in the similar lines. It's something along the lines of, you can love Chicago for its boulevards and avenues, but you can't truly love Chicago until you love its alleys too. There's something like that. And that again is just another, just a few words speaks to his love for the downtrodden and the stepped upon, and his whole life was about uplifting those folks. And I think that's great. And it leads me to my next question, which I always like to ask this one. And a lot of it is, we don't know for sure. So, but in your responses earlier, you had a good point. To answer this question, we have to understand his life he actually did lead. But the question is, how do you think he'd be reacting or engaging with our current world and where we're at? A lot of the same problems he was, trying to bring light to still exist today, if not worse. So I'm curious how you think he'd be engaging with our current world if he were still alive today.
Well, I think, like we talked about, he spent his entire life fighting for against social injustice, be it the Rosenbergs, be it the Hollywood 10. I think he'd be doing the exact same now. Maybe can you mention Algren fighting for climate change, for example, or women's rights, or the current the current Supreme Court decision, Roe v. Wade, things like that. I mean, I could just see him doing that now.
Yeah, agreed. He was, like you mentioned earlier, he was already organizing with protesters when he was alive. He was, chairing or co-chairing committees to combat the Reds, the McCarthyism of the 50s. And it's interesting, like with all the new technology we have too, like, do you think he'd have his own podcast or something? Or like, I feel like he'd be good on Twitter, maybe before Twitter was bought, but I think we just read some of his one-liners. I think he would do great in 280 characters or however much it is now.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because I was just going to say this, you brought me, without you saying that, is that, you know, Ogden was famous for rewriting everything. And all he had was a typewriter back there, but he wrote Man with a Golden Arm, some passages, dozens of times. He rewrote. So I was thinking, Dave, when you said that, just think if he were alive today with a computer, where he wouldn't have to take a piece of paper out of the typewriter. He could just hit backspace and rewrite everything and everything else. How more prolific would he be if he could do that?
Yeah.
That just boggles my mind to think what he could have done with a computer.
Right. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up too, because that from what I was learning, his writing process was like, sometimes he would just get up in the middle of the night, write a little bit, and go back to bed, right?
That's right.
So yeah, do you have any insights into how he started on a novel or story or article or if there are any different approaches he took to different writing styles, like a book review versus a novel or poem, if there's any difference in his approach to those?
Well, I have two thoughts. Number one, he said of his novels, he said any novelist of any value doesn't know what he's doing, because he would just start writing to see what happened. I mean, you know, the people that sell books today, you know, really sell books, they've got a formula and they know exactly where they're going to go with this story. And Ogden never did that. He let it happen. And the second thing was that there's a video, I think, at the Chicago History Museum that showed Ogden talking, and he'd had enough to drink, but he was talking about moving to the East Coast and how he was going to go there. And he started explaining how he's first going to go west and work his way around back to the East Coast. And he was hilarious. So I think, you know, the podcast would have been perfect for him to get his personality out and his thought process. And
I'm picturing him, Art Shea, and Studs Terkel on a podcast together, just talking about whatever they want to. I would love that.
And he kind of did that already with Studs Terkel's radio show. He would
on
Studs' radio show. So in a way, he was almost already doing that. So you're right, Dave. If there had been podcasts now, for sure he would have been doing that.
He was podcasting before it was cool.
Yes, exactly.
He was doing everything before it was cool.
True. Yeah, that's a good point, Sue. Yeah. Getting towards the end here, but we kind of talked about this all in different ways, but if someone asked you, why should I read Nelson Algren today, what would you tell them?
Now, I've been thinking about that question, and it's a hard question, because as Mary Wasinski writes in her, I think it's in her book, that Algren is a hard read. Sue and I both attended the Chicago History Museum's seminars on City in the Make. So as a course, we're studying the book as a course. And I realized it's a hard book to understand and to read. And so why should we tell young people to read a book that's hard to read? But then I realized that maybe we should tell them to read because, and Bill Savage said it much more eloquently than I, but Ogden spoke for the downtrodden. He didn't want to try to rehabilitate the time. He simply wanted to speak about them with compassion, and to make them appear as human beings and not just throwaways. And I think I think because of that, we can identify with these people, because none of us how many of us were born with silver spoons in our mouth? I mean, I know that we all were not. And so I think we can read it because we can identify with the people. Never Come Morning, one of my favorite books, and Bruno Bisek, the famous rape scene where he stands by and lets a gang rape his girlfriend. I mean, how can you not feel compassion for Bruno at this point in time, especially when in frustration he murders the Greek, which becomes his downfall. When you have the very last scene in the book where Bruno says, "I knew I'd never get to be 21 anyhow." I mean, how can you not read that book and be moved? So I guess I'm saying you can read that book to be moved by good writing. And that's what I think Ahlgren left us.
Well said. Yeah. Like you said, good writing and, you know, writers that we still read and talk about, I think their books and stories may be placed in a certain time period, but the human condition is timeless. Things change, technology changes, but we're still trying to figure it out on a day-to-day basis. I think from, I have a lot more of Ahlgren to read, I'll tell you that much, especially after reading your book, Dick, but from what I have read of him, it connects with us, and any reader, I think, can find something to relate to his words and his characters, and even all these years later, I think his themes are timeless, I guess, is what I would say.
And I say, for somebody who hasn't read Ahlgren and needs an introduction, to start with the short stories, the Texas stories, which I don't know if it's in print anymore, but that's how I really slid in. I just fell in love with the Texas stories, and many of those stories are printed up in Neon Wilderness. So it's a good intro.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Was there anything else that either of you wanted to talk about that we didn't cover yet?
Well, could I just say that our museum is in Miller Beach, which is 40 miles away from Chicago. It's less than an hour, and it's open by appointment only. And we do, we bring you past Ahlgren's cabin so you can see it from the street. You cannot walk on the property because it's privately owned, but you can see where Ahlgren walked and where he swam and, had his affairs and what neighbors said about him. And then we go to the museum where you see the collections that we've accumulated. So please come by.
One story, Nate, you probably won't be able to use this on the podcast, on your show, but you can take it out. But I thought you mentioned this too. We both talked about Art Shea's book, Chicago's Nelson Ahlgren, but there's a neat story about this. I've got the book right here. Okay. And as you can see right there, this person right there on the picture, on the cover of that book, at least one writer claims that that person on the cover of that book is the famous Margot that Ahlgren wrote about all the time. And so I don't know if that's true or not. I wanted to ask Art Shea, then he died on me, so I couldn't ask him. But Margot, as you may know, is a euphemism that Ahlgren used for one of his friends, and he helped get her off of drugs. I think he was in love with her too, but didn't work out. And Ahlgren helped her get off drugs, and I think Ahlgren probably would have married her, but I think she wanted someone a little bit more stable in her life, and she married someone. And I think I don't want to say they fell out, but I think sure that toward the end of his life, he had not seen her for many, many years. I know that Margot was a euphemism. Colin Asher, in his biography, writes her real name in his book, and I just kind of felt that there must have been a reason why Ahlgren used his her pseudonym, and I was not about to out her, so I did not use her real name in my book. But I just felt that that's so unusual that at least one person claims that was the famous and elusive Margot, because Colin Asher even writes in his book they tried to track her down. She's fell from Earth, has disappeared.
Interesting. Yeah. I have that. I have Art Shea's book too. So I'll definitely have to take a look at that with hearing this story now. Well, Dick and Sue, thank you again for doing this. I had a blast talking with you, and can't wait to read more Ahlgren, to tell you the truth. And I look forward to hearing what you have going on next year at the museum, Sue, especially the music events seem especially interesting to me, how Ahlgren could impact such a wide range of writers. I mean, they're writers too, but you think normally like other novelists or journalists and stuff, but yeah, that just, I think, speaks to his impact on American culture, let alone writing. So yeah, thanks for talking to me, and have a great day.
Well, thanks for having us. It was a great, great time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.